I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the truly bizarre things that happen when we sleep or don't sleep. We'll spend this hour with neurologist Guy Leschziner, who has treated patients for everything from out-of-control midnight snacking to sleepwalking episodes that included unconscious motorcycle rides to a form of narcolepsy that would cause a patient to collapse every time he told a joke. We'll talk about the growing evidence linking sleep problems to dementia and about why prescription sleeping pills have turned out to be far less helpful than their developers had hoped. Our conversation starts after a short break. Made an appointment with her doctor to talk about her sleep problems. She'd been sleepwalking since she was a kid, once into the woods on a Girl Scout camping trip, but Jackie never grew out of it. In fact, by the time she was in her 70s, it had gotten much worse. In the middle of the night, Jackie would get up, put on clothes, go driving for miles, and return home without any recollection of having left her bed. If her landlady hadn't casually mentioned seeing her on those nighttime jaunts on her motorcycle, Jackie might still be on the road. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Dr. Guy Leschziner is a neurologist, sleep physician, and clinical lead for the Sleep Disorder Center at Guy's Hospital London. The clinic is where physicians refer patients whose sleep problems are so extreme, so bizarre, so hard to resolve, that their needs cannot be met in a standard office visit. Some of these cases can be treated but not cured, but all of them offer fascinating insight into what is supposed to happen when we drift off. Guy Leschziner writes about them in his new book, The Nocturnal Brain: Nightmares, Neuroscience, and the Secret World of Sleep. Guy, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Sleepwalking is relatively common in kids, and that's how it started for Jackie. How did it progress? How could it progress to something so complicated as driving?
Well, we know that sleepwalking, as you say, is so normal in children that it's almost part of childhood. You know, if I pick up my children in the middle of the night, they will often sit up, sometimes even walk, and have no recollection of that. But in about 1% to 2% of adults, that state of being partly awake and partly asleep persists. And we think that the primary cause for that is genetic. People have an underlying genetic predisposition to a brain state whereby part of their brain is awake and part of their brain is in very deep sleep. As things progress in adulthood, some of the features that we see in children, like night terrors, so these are children who will often scream and shout and become very emotional in the middle of the night, usually dissipate and are often replaced by other forms of behaviour, ranging from sleepwalking, sleep talking, and as I detail in my book, sometimes some really complex behaviours like sleep eating, sleep cooking, and in Jackie's case, riding a motorbike or driving a car. What we know happens is that during this state, part of the brain called the frontal lobes, which is really the seat of our rational thinking, of our planning, of our personality, remains in very deep sleep. So it's almost disconnected from the rest of the brain, whereas parts of the brain that are responsible for things like emotion and for movement demonstrate ongoing waking activity. And it's that discord in the brain that results in these really sometimes very complex behaviours.
And it wasn't even that Jackie would wake up and think, oh, I dreamed about driving. She didn't have any memory whatsoever.
Yeah, one of the things that has come to light through the research that has been done is that actually another part of the brain that often remains in very deep sleep during these events is the part of the brain that's responsible for the deposition of memories, an area of the brain called the hippocampus. So it's very common for individuals to really exhibit some incredibly complex behaviours and have no recollection. In the book, I describe another patient who would often cook in the middle of the night or would go down and raid his kitchen of all foodstuff, sometimes even eating things that are really not edible, like coffee grounds or like birdseed, and would have no recollection of it until he came down the following morning and would find evidence of it in the kitchen.
You write also about a patient called Alex, whose parasomnias, which is what I guess that's what you call these times when part of the brain is asleep and part is awake. Is that right?
Yeah, parasomnias really describe any unwanted, unusual behaviors in sleep.
So he had these life and death scenarios going on. So he's up and moving and talking. What exactly was happening in Alex's brain?
So it's a very similar theme that runs through many of these types of parasomnias that we describe as non-REM parasomnias. These are behaviors that arise from a stage of sleep called non-REM sleep, really the deepest stage of sleep, that stage of sleep that is most refreshing for us. And when people are usually woken or partially woken by anything in their environment, be that a plane going overhead or a truck driving past or sometimes even a bed partner rolling over in a creaky bed, that seems to give rise to part of the brain waking up in those susceptible individuals. So in Alex's case, what would often happen is that his parasomnias would often be very emotionally laden. And one of the other areas of the brain that often wakes up is an area of the brain called the limbic system, which is responsible for emotion and emotional processing. If that is awakened and other parts of the brain are asleep, then often the experiences or the behaviors may often have a very intense emotional content. In Alex's case, although he was experiencing these phenomena of disasters, things like tsunamis washing his girlfriend away, and on one occasion he actually dragged his girlfriend out of the bed because he thought he was rescuing her from a giant wave. But in other occasions, his parasomnias are really quite mild, in that one of the other things that he's been described as doing is walking around his house and laying full glasses of water next to the beds of all his housemates, for example. On one occasion, he was seen trying to order a pizza on a telephone, except what he was using as a telephone was his housemate's shoe. So they're not always absolutely terrifying, but certainly, and Alex recognizes this, that when perhaps there are stressful events going on, that gives rise to more of these intense emotional parasomnias.
So many people use alcohol to get sleepy at night, and I've never met a doctor who actually recommends this. It turns out a lot of sleep problems seem to be related to lifestyle factors, environmental factors, which is to say alcohol doesn't help.
No, alcohol really doesn't help. But whilst it is a sedative and it helps people get off to sleep, it actually disrupts sleep quite effectively and makes the quality of sleep rather poorer. I think the other issue with alcohol is that it often makes snoring worse. And alongside snoring comes sleep apnea, which is when people often obstruct their airways in the night and stop breathing for a few seconds. That's a very good disruptor of sleep and can often trigger these kinds of events, but can also create other problems as well.
So how does sleep apnea keep people from getting the benefits of sleep when they sort of feel like they've been out the whole night, but they wake up the next day and they're exhausted?
So if we bring somebody with sleep apnea into the sleep lab and we wire them up, we monitor their brain waves, we monitor their breathing and their heart rate, what we see is that over the course of the night, they will repeatedly, as they go into the deeper stages of sleep, the muscles that keep the airway open tend to lose tension and the airway becomes much more flexible than it otherwise would be during the waking state. If your airway is a little bit narrow, or if you're carrying a bit of excess weight, particularly on your neck, the airway can actually become flexible that it actually collapses down and it obstructs. And when it obstructs, your oxygen levels drop, your heart rate goes up, your brain senses that something's wrong, and there is a partial awakening. Sometimes it can result in a full awakening, but actually more commonly, it just prevents people from remaining in a deeper stage of sleep. So essentially what's happening is that the sleep apnea, the obstruction of the airway, is waking or partially waking you up, is disrupting your sleep, sometimes 20, 30, in the worst cases, 100 or 120 times an hour, every 30 seconds or so. And that can give rise to essentially you perceiving that you've been asleep, but not benefiting from any of the refreshing aspects of sleep. And we know that there are other problems that are associated with obstructive sleep apnea, in that that repeated drop in oxygen, that strain that it puts on the heart, places you at risk of lots of other health issues.
You write about a newly understood system of channels within the brain for, if you'll pardon the expression, like waste disposal, that is called not the lymphatic system, but the glymphatic system.
Yes.
What does this do for us?
So the glymphatic system is a relatively newly discovered system. When I was at medical school, we were told that the lymphatic system, which is the part of the anatomy that really drains extra fluid from our tissues, exists everywhere throughout the body apart from the brain. And in the last few years, we've identified a parallel system called the glymphatic system, which does the same thing in the brain as well. And we know that the glymphatic system seems to open up in the deeper stages of sleep, in a stage of sleep that we call stage 3 sleep. It opens up by about 60%. And we think that one of the fundamental roles of the glymphatic system is to remove toxins, to remove metabolites and excess proteins from the brain. And if you can imagine that you're not getting as much deep sleep, or your deep sleep is disrupted and the glymphatic system is not working as well as it otherwise should be, then one can really understand why it might be the case that these toxins, these metabolites, these proteins build up to levels that should not exist if you were sleeping properly. So the concern is really that actually one of the effects of either very poor sleep or a condition like sleep apnea is that this might result in the buildup of proteins that are actually damaging the brain. And there is an emerging body of evidence tying conditions like sleep apnea or really severe insomnia with conditions that affect memory, things like Alzheimer's disease. Now, that story has not fully been unravelled, but certainly this is a focus of a lot of attention around the world as to a potentially modifiable risk factor for conditions like Alzheimer's.
So there are special machines that are often prescribed to people who have sleep apnea that will kind of force that airway open, right, with positive air pressure. Lots of people really find them hard to tolerate.
Yes, certainly in our experience, after a year, only about 50% of people carry on with these machines. Essentially what you're doing is you're taking a mask, you're strapping it tight to your face, it's attached to a machine that generates positive pressure, and it splints the airway open. For some people, CPAP, or APAP as it's termed, is a life-changing machine. It suddenly results in a dramatic change in the quality of sleep that people are getting, and people can feel completely transformed by this machine, but it's not without its difficulties. And for many people, actually using these machines can be incredibly cumbersome and can sometimes make sleep worse rather than better.
So for most of us, it's just natural to be alert during the day and sleepy at night. You worked with a teenager who'd had a couple of surgeries and ended up suffering a side effect that no one predicted in advance. So tell us about Vincent.
So Vincent was a young boy who had had some issues with his hips. And had always been what we term a night owl, somebody who tends to want to go to sleep very late and wake up very late. Now, anybody who's got children will realise that actually that's a fairly standard state of affairs for teenagers in particular. And we know that our internal body clock, our circadian rhythm, shifts as we go through life. For Vincent, that was a bit more pronounced. But after his surgeries, when he underwent a period of very, very poor sleep indeed, something happened to his circadian rhythm, to his internal body clock, whereas rather than running on a 24-hour rhythm, his circadian rhythm seemed to shift so that it was running on a 25-hour rhythm. Hmm. And so every day he would be wanting to go to bed an hour later and wanting to wake up an hour later. This is something called a non-24-hour circadian rhythm disorder, which, as I illustrate in the book, really had some devastating consequences, in that for about 1 week every month he would be in sync with the world around him, but for the rest of the time he would be wanting to go to sleep and wake up at very odd hours, with devastating effects on his social life, on his education, on really every aspect of his life.
My guest is Dr. Guy Leschziner, a neurologist and sleep physician who is clinical lead for the Sleep Disorders Center at Guy's Hospital, London. His new book is called The Nocturnal Brain: Nightmares, Neuroscience, and the Secret World of Sleep. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is neurologist Guy Leschziner, clinical lead for the Sleep Disorders Center at Guy's Hospital, London, and author of The Nocturnal Brain: Nightmares, Neuroscience, and the Secret World of Sleep. Just for a minute, back to Vincent, Guy. Why might a surgery have thrown his circadian rhythm out of whack?
Well, I think the short answer is we don't fully know. We know that circadian rhythms are very vulnerable to environmental factors like light, like when we eat, like when we exercise. But when people are blind, we often see that their circadian rhythms are off track. So people who are completely blind, who can't perceive light, often have abnormalities of their internal body clock. Non-24-hour rhythm disorder, which is what Vincent had, is actually incredibly rare in sighted individuals, in people who can perceive light. But there is some commonality in many of the people who experience this 25-hour rhythm in that they often have a preceding history of what we term delayed sleep phase disorder, when people are these extreme night owls. And we think that what might be happening is that when sleep is disrupted for whatever reason, then the factors that perhaps would normally bring the circadian rhythm back under control are no longer able to compensate. And that results in this change in the circadian rhythm where essentially the internal body clock loses some control and results in this slightly longer rhythm. But I think the short answer is we just don't know.
There are some jobs that require people to work what most of us consider to be odd hours all through the night, sleeping during the day. You've discovered, or our scientists have discovered, that folks who do this kind of shift work have higher rates of certain cancers and diabetes and heart disease and gastrointestinal problems. Does that have to do with them not sleeping enough because they're out of sync with the rest of the world? Or is there something about being awake when it's dark and it's asleep when it's light that causes problems?
I think it's probably both. We know that lack of sleep, insufficient sleep, is in itself associated with a range of poor health outcomes. But there are some theories that the normal secretion of melatonin, which is a hormone that a part of the brain called the pineal gland in the brain pushes out, which is really of fundamental importance to regulating our circadian rhythm, might actually have some protective effects against cancer. And some studies have demonstrated that if you don't have a normal melatonin secretion, you might be at increased risk of these cancers. But there are also circadian clocks in various organs of our bodies. So there is the master clock, which is seated deep within the brain in an area called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. But each organ, the gut, the liver, the lungs, the heart, all have their own timekeepers, their own clocks within them. And it's when there is a conflict between the master clock or the behaviour that we undertake, like, for example, eating at the wrong time, that may actually put additional stresses on the body. It may alter the way that we process certain foods or metabolites that might have long-term health consequences as well.
There are medications that can make us drowsy and keep us asleep for hours at a time. And there was a time when it felt like sleeping pills might be the solution to the problems of people who don't sleep well. Why have so many doctors backed off using them?
Well, we know that sleeping tablets, first of all, they don't mimic natural sleep. What they do, they act as sedatives. They really push you into sleep, but the quality of that sleep is not the same as natural sleep. But it's not only that. We now know that many of these drugs are associated with a range of problems. First of all, people often develop a dependency. They often require increasing doses of drugs to try and get the same sedating effect. Many of these drugs result in daytime sedation. So there are the clear correlations between certain drugs and, for example, the risk of road traffic accidents in the morning or the risk of falls, particularly in elderly individuals, which creates problems as well. And so there has been a general sea change in how we deal with insomnia. We think that insomnia is primarily something that's termed psychophysiological, so that there are psychological factors and also physiological factors that give rise to a loss of the association between being in bed and falling asleep. And so using non-drug-based techniques like a treatment called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia has now been demonstrated to be probably as efficacious, as effective as many of these drugs, and in the long term doesn't create some of the issues surrounding these drugs. I think there's one further issue with regard to many of the drugs that have historically been used for insomnia, and that is that studies have demonstrated that many of these drugs are associated with an increased risk of conditions like Alzheimer's disease, which has really led people to use these drugs with a great deal of caution. Now, some of that association may be explained by the fact that actually poor sleep in itself might be a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, or that actually in the very early stages of Alzheimer's disease, sleep may deteriorate anyway. But it certainly looks like a distinct possibility that some of these drugs may fundamentally alter chemicals within the brain that give rise to cognitive problems.
All right. We have an email here from Penny in Richardson who says, my grandmother had night terrors. She woke us up screaming. Back then, we joked it off. Now I'm having night terrors. They started a few years ago. I'm even seeing the same shadowy man in my room that she did. Is this hereditary and will it get worse as I age?
Well, it's the first issue is whether or not these are really night terrors. We know that one of the things that can often occur later on in life is a condition called REM sleep behavior disorder, which is when people start acting out their dreams. Now, these are somewhat different from night terrors in that they occur in what we term REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, which is the stage of sleep during which we have these dreams of a narrative structure, a plot evolving in our imagination. In normal circumstances, we're completely paralyzed. We are unable to move pretty much every muscle in our bodies during REM sleep. The exception to that are the muscles that move our eyes, hence the term rapid eye movement sleep, and the muscles that we use to breathe. But in some individuals, as they get older, that mechanism of paralysis that is a part and parcel of REM sleep doesn't kick in properly, and then people start acting out their dreams and will often lash out or kick out or scream or shout. And that is somewhat different. Now, in some families, we do see a hereditary component, but these conditions, REM sleep behavior disorder, is associated with certain other neurological disorders. So I think the devil is in the detail, and it really is important to clarify whether or not these really are night terrors or whether these represent REM sleep behavior disorder.
Some people, Penny also mentioned seeing a shadowy man in her room. Some people, like you write about, suffer hallucinations as they're awakening from sleep. So how are those hallucinations different from just a dream?
Well, I think that those hallucinations may well be fragments of a dream entering into full consciousness. There are a number of phenomena that people experience at the transition from REM sleep, dreaming sleep, to wakefulness, and those include what we term hypnagogic or hypnopompic hallucinations. These are often figures standing over the end of the bed, or occasionally an intruder sitting on top of you. Rarely people experience out-of-body experiences where they see themselves from above as if they're floating above their sleeping selves. But another thing that often occurs within that transition between REM sleep and wakefulness is something called sleep paralysis, where that paralysis that I was talking about, that is part and parcel of REM sleep, continues into wakefulness. And people experience full wakefulness, but the paralysis has not eased off yet, and so they will feel paralyzed. And it's the dream mentation, the dream imagery, and the paralysis of REM sleep intruding into wakefulness that often gives rise to these hallucinations or the sleep paralysis.
You've experienced sleep paralysis. You're an expert in this stuff. You knew what it was, and it was still really freaky.
It was a deeply distressing experience. It was after a 24-hour flight from Australia. My body clock was all over the place. I had terrible jet lag. I'd bought some melatonin in the States and thought it would be a good idea to try some in order to get my clock back into sync. And I had terrible sleep paralysis. It was very, very, very frightening.
So could someone have awakened you by sort of tapping you, and would that have ended the paralysis had they known what you were going through?
A lot of people say that if they are touched by their bed partner, or if they manage to move a little finger or a toe, they can suddenly break that sleep paralysis. So that's a very common technique that people use in order to get rid of it.
So you write about the Disney film Cinderella, and there's a dog in there that is sort of depicted as dreaming about chasing this cat. I used to have a dog that did this. Like, you could hear her sort of barking under her breath and scrabbling her little legs like she was chasing something. It turns out this might be caused by a brainstem disorder.
So we know that this mechanism of paralysis that I was talking about during dreaming is really part and parcel of the stage of REM sleep. But that mechanism is mediated by a number of areas of the brain in the brainstem. This is the bit of the brain that gives rise to the spinal cord as it exits the skull. And when those areas of the brain are in some way damaged or don't work properly, that's when that paralysis is lost. This condition, REM sleep behaviour disorder, that I was talking about is actually fascinating from a historical perspective, because actually it was described in Cinderella, both in Bruno the dog, but also in The King, when he dreams of his grandchildren that are yet to be born playing with him. Came out in 1950, which was several years before this condition was properly described in animals, and about 30 or 40 years before REM sleep behavior disorder, this condition was actually formally described in human beings. And whilst we know that certain drugs can cause this, while this can run in families, we're now beginning to understand that what is often the cause of this is that it is an early sign of conditions like Parkinson's disease. So we think of conditions like Parkinson's disease, the difficulty walking, the tremor, the stiffness, as being just that. But what we understand now is that the changes that occur in the part of the brain called the basal ganglia, which give rise to the manifestations of Parkinson's disease, often start in different parts of the brain many years beforehand. And we now are beginning to appreciate that people who have REM sleep behavior disorder may actually be in the very early stages of these kinds of conditions, sometimes years, even decades before Parkinson's disease manifests.
That seems like it would promise possibly early diagnosis and dopamine therapy or something that might stave off Parkinson's.
Yes, this is an area of great excitement, actually, from a research perspective, because if we can identify people who are at very high risk of developing conditions like Parkinson's disease, and we identify drugs that could potentially either stop the progression of Parkinson's disease or prevent its onset, then people with REM sleep behavior disorder and perhaps a variety of other features that put them at very high risk would be really ideal candidates for trying some of these preventative treatments.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I have to tell you, if I hadn't read it in your book, I'm not sure that I would have believed sexsomnia was really a thing. You tell the story of a man called Tom that is just truly bizarre.
Yes, I'm often asked about this because it often captures people's imagination. So Tom was somebody who had a predisposition to sleepwalking and had a rather unfortunate incident with his ex-partner with whom he was sharing a bed. And the episode culminated in him being accused and subsequently convicted and imprisoned for rape. It only came to light in a later relationship that actually this was a relatively common occurrence that he would initiate sexual behaviour in his sleep. This is termed sexsomnia and is really part of the range of conditions that we talked about earlier, these non-REM parasomnias, behaviours that arise in very deep sleep when part of the brain is awake and part of the brain is asleep. Now, obviously, sexsomnia is increasingly being used as a defence in these sorts of cases, and one has to interpret the stories with a degree of caution. But as I outline in the book, there are some fairly convincing features of Tom's case to suggest that actually he really genuinely was exhibiting one of these sexsomnia behaviours that resulted in his conviction.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Allie calling us from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Allie.
Hi. My question is about nightmares. I've always been a deep sleeper. I fall asleep right away. I don't snore or sleepwalk, but I've always had very detailed dreams that I almost always remember in the morning. And it's usually fine, except when I have a nightmare. They're usually very detailed and graphic and sometimes violent. And this actually happened to me last night. I got 9 hours of sleep, but part of that sleep was a nightmare, and I woke up feeling like I hadn't slept at all. I actually had to leave work today because I just felt like I hadn't slept through the night, and I'm just wondering, is that a different form of sleep apnea where just part of the brain, the imagination, is awake, and that's why I'm not feeling like I've slept at all?
Thanks so much for your call.
So, you know, nightmares are a very common problem. And we know that, for example, individuals who've undergone trauma and who have post-traumatic stress disorder often have recurrent nightmares, often related to the trauma that they've experienced. People generally only tend to remember dreams or nightmares if they've woken up from REM sleep. And so sometimes in certain individuals, we see certain sleep disorders that give rise to recurrent awakenings in REM sleep, in dreaming sleep. And it's those individuals who often have very frequent, vivid dreams, sometimes nightmares if there's a very, very strong emotional content. So the first thing that we would do is really look to see whether or not there is anything that's disrupting REM sleep, like, for example, a very mild form of sleep apnea that might be giving rise to these events. There is a theory about dreaming, that actually dreaming, that one of the functions of dreaming is about psychological healing. So taking certain memories and cleansing them of their emotional context, which is perhaps why people with post-traumatic stress disorder don't overcome their trauma, because they're having these recurrent nightmares that never fully complete. And it may simply be that the emotional content of the dream, the emotional content of the nightmare, is in itself waking you up. So we know that certain conditions like anxiety...
I need to jump in here very quickly, excuse me. My guest is Dr. Guy Leschziner. We're talking about his book, The Nocturnal Brain. We'll be right back. Speaking this hour with neurologist Dr. Guy Leschziner, who is clinical lead for the Sleep Disorder Center at Guy's Hospital London and author of The Nocturnal Brain, Nightmares, Neuroscience, and the Secret World of Sleep. Before the break, Guy, you were explaining to Allie that nightmares can be a manifestation of anxiety, the brain's way of dealing with it.
Yes, so really anything that causes a very strong emotional context to your dreams may give rise to you waking up from REM sleep and may give rise to these nightmares. Sometimes it is, as I said, related to anxiety, for example, but other times it isn't. Other times it's just the way that you are spending your time in REM sleep. There are a number of different treatment options available, some of which are non-drug-based treatments like dream image rehearsal therapy, but sometimes drugs are used in very rare cases. But certainly if you're having very frequent nightmares, then it is worth going to see your sleep physician, having a sleep study to see if there's anything that might be disrupting your sleep from a physical perspective, and then trying to seek some sort of resolution.
Babies in the womb seem to spend a lot of time dreaming, but with only very limited sensory experience on which to draw, what might they be dreaming about?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'm not sure we're able to answer that. I think it raises the question as to what REM sleep is about. What is dreaming about? And I think the short answer is that we still don't know, which is really rather remarkable, considering that this is something that happens every night to all of us, whether we remember it or not. To ask, well, why do we dream, is a bit like asking, well, why do we eat, or why do we drink? If you said, I don't know, to those questions, it would be laughable, and yet we still don't know why we dream. It's likely that actually dreaming or REM sleep has different functions at different stages of life. And one of the theories as to why as children, as babies, we spend so much time in REM sleep is that this is actually about forming the connections within our brain that actually allow us higher levels of consciousness. So the development of consciousness that really differentiates us from more primitive animals.
You write that in the strange world of sleep disorders, there is no condition as extraordinary as Klein-Levin syndrome. So what does that do to us?
So Klein-Levin syndrome is an incredibly rare condition. It affects between about 1 in 1 million and 5 in 1 million individuals throughout the world. It varies according to where you are in the world, but by and large, it's still pretty rare wherever you are. This is a condition that often affects young individuals. It often comes on in the teenage years. And individuals are generally entirely normal, with the exception of episodes, which last anything between a few days, sometimes to a few weeks, during which their behavior changes completely. They become really quite profoundly sleepy. They become a bit aggressive and irritable. They will often have a poor memory for these events and will often become rather disinhibited. In fact, sexual disinhibition is often a hallmark of Klein-Levin syndrome. And this condition often arises for a few years and then disappears quite as mysteriously as it's arisen, although in some cases it can persist for decades. We really don't have any fundamental idea of what causes it, but we do know that it seems to have an underlying physiological and underlying biological basis rather than being a psychiatric condition, in that there is evidence of changes in brain waves and changes in certain types of brain scans that occur in individuals with this condition.
So I don't know if you have TV ads in the UK for drugs, prescription drugs.
We don't. I'm always fascinated when I come to the States and see adverts for very expensive drugs that most people in the UK would never come across.
Right. Okay. Well, I think the UK maybe is doing it right. But a lot of people a few years ago, when drugs came out for restless leg syndrome, it became like this big joke. And people thought that, you know, drug companies were basically pathologizing something that wasn't a problem before. Reading your book, it becomes clear that this can be like a life-altering condition for people who have it.
Yeah, absolutely. I've often heard it said in the UK as well that actually restless leg syndrome is a condition that was really made up by the pharmaceutical companies in order to sell drugs. When people have written things like that in the newspapers, I've often invited them to come and sit in on my clinics, but they've never actually taken me up on my offer. I see a number of individuals who have really quite devastating restless leg syndrome. This is when people, particularly in the evenings, but sometimes during the day as well, experience an uncomfortable sensation, usually in their legs, although it's not only in the legs, that comes on in the evening, that is worsened by immobility. And they, when they get up and move around, that sensation eases, only for it to come back as soon as they get back into bed. So this can result in really devastating sleep problems. And we know that it is actually a genuine thing because we've identified genetic markers for this condition. And in fact, many people who have restless leg syndrome also have leg movements that arise from sleep, from very deep sleep. So, you know, obviously indicating that this is a genuine problem that is not put on, it's not imaginary, that it exists even in very deep sleep.
Why would it only happen to people who are going to sleep? Like, why is it worse in the evenings? Does anyone know?
Well, we think that one of the fundamental issues in restless leg syndrome is an abnormality in which the brain processes and detects a neurotransmitter called dopamine, which I'm sure many people will be very familiar with. And actually, dopamine levels tend to drop in the evening as we start feeling sleepy and start getting ready for bed. And it's that drop in natural dopamine that results in these symptoms coming on in the evening or in the night. In people who have had restless leg syndrome for many years, or perhaps have been treated with very high doses of certain drugs, actually that can result in a dramatic worsening whereby people can get the symptoms of restless leg syndrome from the moment they wake up in the morning. So whilst we typically consider this as being a condition of the nighttime, a condition of the evening, actually in some cases it can devastate people's waking lives as well.
I guess I thought I knew what narcolepsy was, but I had never heard about anybody like Adrian before I came across this book. He had narcolepsy with what's called cataplexy. How did that affect him?
So narcolepsy is a neurological disorder whereby a part of the brain, really a very crucial but very small part of the brain that's involved in switching sleep on and off and also regulating dreaming sleep and non-dreaming sleep, is damaged. It's damaged by our immune system, usually in response to some sort of environmental trigger like an infection. And this results in people falling asleep very easily during the day, but also having difficulty staying asleep at night. Because they flick in and out of dreaming sleep very easily, they also frequently experience the hallucinations that we were talking about, the hypnagogic and hypnopompic hallucinations, and sleep paralysis. But actually, a majority of people with narcolepsy also experience this phenomenon called cataplexy, which is when usually triggered by very strong emotion, often laughter or mirth, they suddenly lose tone within their muscles. And this often results in them collapsing to the ground or occasionally slumping over, which, when you first hear it, sounds rather funny. But as I describe Adrian and Phil's case, can really have some devastating consequences on your ability to work, on your ability to interact with people around you, with your family, does need treatment.
Is there a cure?
At the moment, there's no cure for narcolepsy. Once you have it, you are left with it for the rest of your life. But we do have an increasing number of treatment options available to us. In fact, in the States, the last month or two, there have been two new drugs that have come to market. So our toolbox for managing narcolepsy is improving very quickly. And actually, for many people, narcolepsy can be well controlled.
All right, let's go back to the phone. Savannah is calling from Cleburne, Texas. Hi, Savannah.
Hi. I have a 7-year-old who has been experiencing very frequent episodes of sleepwalking. He will carry conversation with you. He has thought he is in the bathroom to pee, and he is not. That's been kind of fun. But we have changed eating habits. He's on a pretty constant sleep schedule. Is there anything else that I might be able to try to prevent his sleepwalking, or do we just kind of have to wait it out?
Thanks for calling.
Well, I think that, as I said, sleepwalking is incredibly common in childhood. And, unless it's causing major problems, we generally recommend that people wait it out. But one of the things that some people do find useful is a technique called anticipatory waking. This is when you actually wake your child up roughly 20 minutes, 15 minutes before their typical sleepwalking events happen. And what that sometimes does is prevents them from going into quite as deep sleep as they otherwise would, can sometimes prevent the sleepwalking events from occurring. Certainly, I think my pediatric colleagues would be very reluctant to go down the route of medications, but anticipatory waking is certainly worth trying.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the best way to guide someone who is sleepwalking back into safely into bed?
I think the answer to that is very gently, because what you want to try and avoid, particularly in adults, and this used to be thought of as a bit of an old wives' tale, is try not to wake somebody up who's sleepwalking, because that might be dangerous to them. In actual fact, occasionally what has been described as people becoming violent or aggressive when they've been woken up. So gently guiding them back to sleep and back to the bed is probably the best way of dealing with them.
So you mentioned, insomnia. Lots of people find this to be really disruptive, but sleep labs have discovered that sometimes we think we're sleeping a lot or we're not sleeping very much at all. And in fact, we're sleeping quite a bit more than we think.
Yeah. So the phrase that I always use is that the experience of sleep is subjective as well as objective. And certainly there is a subgroup of individuals who have what's termed sleep state misperception or paradoxical insomnia. People often think that they have slept very little, but actually have slept much more than they are aware of. One of the reasons for that is that it may be that when people wake up at certain times, their brain fills in the bits between those awakenings as being awake, whereas actually when we put them in the sleep lab, we'll often see that they've gone into very deep sleep. And that's a very common experience. Now, as a rule, we tend not to bring in people with insomnia into the sleep lab unless we're suspicious that there may be other issues going on, or that they've got very difficult to treat insomnia, in which case we really are looking for alternative explanations. But that's not an uncommon finding when we do bring in people into the sleep laboratory.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, very quickly, let's go to Matt calling from Fort Worth. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I had a question if there had ever been studies of correlations between headaches affecting REM sleep, or if REM sleep can actually trigger headache.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, so there is a phenomenon called hypnic headache, which is when people suddenly wake up in the middle of the night with a terrible headache that does, in some cases, appear to be locked to REM sleep. And now, whilst we don't fully understand the mechanism by which that arises, certainly there are things that can be done to try and treat hypnic headache. Things like, and it sounds somewhat bizarre, but giving people caffeine before they go to bed can sometimes be a very effective treatment for hypnic headache. Occasionally, what we do is we give people drugs to disrupt REM sleep. So that's a very well-recognized phenomenon.
There are a number of electronic devices around these days that promise to help us track our sleep. Can they tell us anything we don't already know?
That's a really good question. I think the answer to that is that many of these devices that exist in the market at the moment, they're pretty good at telling us when we're in bed. Some of them are reasonably good at telling us when we're asleep. But what they're not very good at the moment is telling us about sleep stages and brief awakenings and things like that. My own view is that if you know you're not sleeping enough and you're using a sleep tracker to perhaps try and guide you to change your lifestyle in order to enable you to spend a bit more time in bed and sleep a little bit more, then that's not necessarily a bad thing. But one of the things that we very frequently see is that people who have insomnia, who are, you know, certainly have a degree of anxiety around their sleep anyway, are often reliant on these devices. And these devices, because of their inaccuracy, may actually give you a very false impression of what your sleep is like. And it causes people to increase their fixation about their sleep and can, in some circumstances, actually make insomnia worse rather than better. So as a general rule, I would suggest that if you do have insomnia, if you are worried about your sleep, you avoid using these devices at the current time.
Dr. Guy Leschziner is a neurologist, sleep physician, and clinical lead for the Sleep Disorders Center at Guy's Hospital, London. His book is called The Nocturnal Brain, Nightmares, Neuroscience, and the Secret World of Sleep. Guy, it's been fascinating. Thanks so much for making time to speak with
us. It's my pleasure. Thank you for talking to me.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERAThink. You can subscribe to our podcast and learn about upcoming shows at think.kera.org, or you can subscribe at your favorite podcast server. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.